Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly Utah news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Utah's spike in coronavirus cases rolls on unabated. After 35 years of ownership, the Miller family is selling the Utah Jazz. Utah's two oldest and largest newspapers announced that they'll stop daily printing in 2021. And more Utah women are donating to Joe Biden's campaign as President Trump struggles with female voters. Joining me on the phone this morning to talk about all of this, we've got Salt Lake Tribune interim editor David Noyce. Good morning and welcome, Dave.
Hi, Roger.
Hi, thanks for being here. Reporter Taylor Stevens is with us as well, and welcome to you, Taylor.
Good morning.
Good morning. And news columnist Robert Gerke, good morning to you, Robert.
Hi. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning. I already said that. Listeners, if you'd like to submit your questions and comments about the stories that we are covering today, you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW, and you can call us. The number to call is 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. We will start today with coronavirus news. Utah continues to see significantly high case counts and our hospitalizations and deaths. Lagging indicators are catching up to that. I'm just going to run through the latest data. 10 new deaths were added to the official tally yesterday, 10 on Monday as well. More than 1,800 cases reported yesterday. Our rate of positivity, meaning the percentage of tests conducted that are coming back positive, that is at its highest ever, 18.1%. And hospitalizations, that's where state leaders are getting worried, worried that there won't be enough space, or actually not even so much that as that the intensive care personnel aren't going to be there for people who get sick. As we did at the beginning of last week's show, we're going to start with a clip just to set the stage, an audio clip, and then we'll come back and talk about this. But here are the voices of Governor Gary Herbert, state epidemiologist Dr. Angela Dunn, Rich Saunders, director of the Utah Health Department, Greg Bell, the head of the Utah Hospital Association, and Dr. Mark Shaw, an emergency physician with Intermountain Healthcare, from yesterday's COVID-19 briefing.
The hospitals, frankly, just can't keep up with the trend that we have going now as more and more people are going to be demanding hospital care.
We continually are looking at our hospital utilization as a key metric to try to protect. And our seven-day rolling average of ICU utilization across the state is at 72.6%. However, our key referral hospitals continue to report higher occupancy and a high strain on their healthcare providers.
When you layer on top of a very efficient system in the state of Utah, another 20 to 25%, perhaps 30% of patients who need very critical intensive care, then that strains and could overstrain our resources.
It's not just about COVID. It's about anyone who has an issue that takes them to the hospital. A heart attack patient, for example, that might not be able to get into the hospital quickly enough for treatment. It's about patients waiting for hours and hours for an emergency surgery or emergency care.
We can continue to argue and disagree about lots of things. Politics and sports, upcoming election. We cannot continue to argue about masking. We cannot continue to argue about whether this pandemic is real or made up. And we cannot continue to argue that healthcare will do just fine regardless of the demand. That is not true.
Okay, so an alarm bell being sounded there. But Robert Gerke, news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune, alarm bells, you know, have been ringing. Are people, is the public paying attention?
Well, I mean, that's the big question, right? I think if leaders didn't have the public's attention before, they hopefully have it now. It's hard to really put it to gauge how much people are complying with these requests to do, to do social distancing and mask mandates and so forth. The polling, the state conducts a weekly poll, and the most recent one said about less than two-thirds of Utahns were actually complying with the mask requirements, and women were doing it at a much higher rate than men. So, you know, that's not enough. Two-thirds is not what we want to be seeing right now, especially as, you know, when the situation is getting critical. And I think something that's often missed is that it's going to get more critical. As you mentioned at the outset, we've been seeing record numbers of cases. We've had 11 straight days where, you know, we've set a new high for that particular day. And those people are still a few weeks out from showing up at the hospital. And so, while things are really bad right now, they're going to get a lot worse over the next 2 weeks. And if people aren't paying attention, they need to, and they need to do it quickly.
I guess a follow-up question there is you know, ringing the alarm bells over and over again enough then, if that's what the polling shows is such low, you know, adoption of wearing masks or whatever?
Well, and keep in mind that poll is over a week old now, I guess, since they did it. So it's kind of, maybe people are doing a better job. Maybe they're doing a better job of staying at home. We haven't seen that yet in the numbers, and we should be seeing that by now. The governor put this into effect, I believe it was 16 days ago, is when the mask requirement, the mask mandate for most of the state took effect. And in fact, today, as of today, it expires in Iron County. That's the way it worked. The governor put a two-week circuit breaker on where counties that have a moderate risk level are required to wear masks. That expires today. Iron County is the only one that's still in moderate, because right. Most of the counties have moved from moderate to high risk in that period of time. Again, the trend is not good, and in fact, the case growth is accelerating, not decelerating like we'd like to see it. So right now, there's no indication that anything the governor's done, anything the state's done, has actually worked. And the next steps, are kind of challenging for the governor. He doesn't want to, close restaurants, close bars, close businesses, maybe close schools. These are things that he's obviously tried to avoid. And I think the problem that we're in right now is because they did avoid this for so long, and they avoided taking the steps that they should have taken when we first started seeing this spike back in early to mid-September. And so now we're in a pretty dire predicament. We're not alone in this. Obviously, there's a lot of states around the country that are seeing these kinds of spikes, and nationwide, the numbers are up. We had, I believe, our highest number of cases since the outbreak began yesterday. And that's going to be followed by deaths. And it's unfortunate. And we've got to get our hands around this quickly. I mean, again, the hospitals are going to be overwhelmed, and it's just a question of how long they can hold on.
Part of the crisis standards of care that they're talking about implementing is making choices. And that means hospitals facing that grim reality of having to ration care, meaning prioritizing care for some people and turning other people away. The director of the Utah Hospital Association, Greg Bell, says that we don't know exactly when that will happen. But the way things are going, it's not looking good. It's looking pretty bad, actually. Robert, you pointed out that most of Utah's counties, 23 of Utah's 29 counties, are now in the high transmission area, are now considered a high transmission area. And that means that by public health order, masks are required in those counties. Whenever you're in proximity to someone who isn't a member of your household, public gatherings are limited to 10 people or fewer. Are those just words, or is there some bite to them? Obviously, you're sending the message that this is what people should be doing. Are people doing it?
Yeah.
Is the question, and I guess we'll find that out.
Yeah, the enforcement on this has been weak, and anecdotally, you hear from people who say that in many parts of the state, they're not taking this seriously. You hear down in Washington County, for example, the masks are not being worn. They're not being required. There's no enforcement for people who don't wear them, either on the businesses for not requiring them or, on the people who are not wearing them. It's kind of mind-boggling in a way, but there's never been really an enforcement piece to this. You've always been counting on businesses to enforce it in their, within their four walls and for people to do the right thing. And it doesn't seem to be having the desired effect, at least not yet. The crisis standards of care you mentioned, I think, are an important point, because Dr. Mark Shaw, who led the committee that drafted the crisis standards of care for the state, I talked to him back in July when we were, had our first big peak.
Yeah.
And it's kind of daunting. It's a little bit frightening to think about. doctors being put in a position where they say, well, you're elderly or you have pre-existing conditions, we don't have enough beds, we're going to put you in hospice, or we're going to try to, you know, alleviate your pain, but there's nothing else we can do because we don't have the resources. Right. And that's what we're up against.
Right. Basically, I'm just going to interrupt you for a second, Robert, and say that it's about crisis standards of care involves caring for people who are most likely to recover. And so that might mean turning away people who as you said, have issues that or are just older and have less of a chance of surviving the virus.
Yeah, yeah. And he made clear yesterday there are contingencies they put in place, things they try to do to avoid getting to that point where they have to start just denying people care. But, and he said those contingencies also erode the standard of care that people are going to be getting in the hospitals. But when they get to the point where they have to start assigning people scores based on their age, based on their pre-existing conditions, you know, that's sort of a ghastly thought to think about. Mm. That it boils down to what your number is. I mean, a tiebreaker, for example, is a pregnant woman will get treatment before somebody who's not,
right.
Because they consider that two lives. And so, you know, this is the reality that we are on the verge of facing now, and we will be facing within the next 2 weeks if we don't get this thing under control and start bringing the curve back down.
I feel like we can't not mention the fact that there was a protest at the home of the state epidemiologist yesterday, people opposed to mask wearing, people, rejecting science. Robert, a vocal minority, and I want your comments on that, but I also wonder if the growth in cases that we're seeing currently in the state of Utah, is that really from people who are anti-science, or is it instead from, the rational people who are just getting complacent and letting their guard down? Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a couple of things to talk about there. One is the protest,
yeah.
And the other is where these cases are coming from.
Well, I think it's a little bit, to some extent, it's all of the above. I mean, you've got, to the best of our knowledge, the contact tracing that is done shows that most of the spread is happening in households, and that happens when you have an infected family member or, housemate who then brings it home to you. It's hard to control, and that's the bulk of the spread. Social gatherings are something that they've pointed to repeatedly over the last several weeks because, and that goes to the point that you were making, that maybe we're getting complacent. Maybe we've been doing too many of these group gatherings where the virus can spread easily. And we've got to keep in mind at this point that about one in about 112, 113 Utahns has an active case of coronavirus. That doesn't mean that they're out there spreading it, that they're shedding a lot of it, but that means there's potential for that, certainly. Mm-hmm. And so, when you look around, you've got to kind of do the math in your head and think that, well, if we're having a group of people together, there's not just a possibility, but, a decent possibility that somebody is going to be have the virus. So, when we're going into public places and so forth, we've got to be smart about how the precautions we take and how we limit that potential exposure, because I think, like I said, the governor, Angela Dunn, others have said repeatedly that these social gatherings, these small social gatherings, are the things that are causing a good deal of the spread, and they're very hard to control. I mean, you can't control necessarily when people gather in their backyard or gather for a birthday party or something like that. Then there is, as you mentioned, this element of people who, no matter what the evidence, no matter what the science, no matter what the crisis that we're facing is, they're going to be resistant to any government intervention because, and that led to the protest that was at Dr. Dunn's house yesterday. It was a small protest. I think they had about 10 people in the morning hours, and then they had about a dozen, maybe a little bit more, in the evening. There was large police presence. I think there were I think they had two cruisers there in the morning and three in the evening. And it went without incident. Some of the neighbors confronted them on the sidewalk and, encouraged them to get out. But I think the thing that I was chagrined about, I guess, is that, Dr. Dunn doesn't have any decision-making authority. The decisions are made by the governor and her boss, Rich Saunders, the director of the health department. So to focus this on somebody who is a scientist and is trying to advise the governor and state leaders to the best of her ability, I think was really out of line. And she said it's taken a toll on her and her family. And she said it's wrong. The governor initially said it's not the best use of their time, which was a pretty tepid response, but came out later after he took a bunch of heat for that. And it issued a stronger response, calling on them to, you know, cancel the protest and to comply with the state's requirements or requests on wearing masks. They didn't cancel the protests. I don't imagine that they're going to comply with any of the state's requirements on masks going forward. But, you know, you kind of see the way this whole thing has become politicized, like everything in our nation, and the way that, you know, reason has in some cases gone right out the window.
You know, maybe I'll bring David Noyes, the Tribune's interim editor, in on this. And I'm not certain the question to ask you here, David, but it has to do with covering. I mean, Robert Gierke's talking about reason going out the window. And I guess I'm wondering how you cover, as a news organization, the sort of anti-rational or anti-reason elements without necessarily amplifying their message and thereby, you know, adding to the public health crisis that is playing out. Do you know what I mean? Is there a balance there when you look at how you conduct the coverage of that sort of movement?
It's always going to be, I guess, a somewhat case by case, as most ethical, and which I do think this is an ethical decision that a news organization has to make. You're hesitant to give a publicity or a forum to movements or people who are just wrong. They're just plainly wrong. At the same time, sometimes you want to expose that and correct it for people, hopefully. But, you know, if we spent all of our time fact-checking and correcting all the wrong information out there, our paper would be filled with nothing but that. So that's the tough decision. I mean, we had several examples this past week of stories that were kind of anti-mask. You know, the thing that happened at Lehigh's Farmers Market, of course, where it's in Utah County, people should be wearing masks, and one vendor there was trying to encourage people apparently to wear masks, and there was some kind of dispute, and he either left or was thrown out, depending on whose version you want to believe. People should have been wearing masks. I think there was probably value in reporting that, but just as long as we're continuing to report what the scientists are saying needs to happen. So, you know, it's a case by case call.
Yeah.
Because you do want to spread good information, but you also, if you feel like it's going to be effective in correcting that bad information that might be out there, then there can be value in that.
Of course, yeah. Robert Gierke, just I'll ask for you, you know, to provide any comment there yourself on this, and then or maybe on our COVID response in general, just before we move on to a break, and then other news from this past week.
Well, I think Dave kind of hit it on the head. This is behind the headlines here. When we heard about this protest, we were debating whether we cover it or not, because a lot of what they want is attention. And, you know, it's sort of, you know, and if you for those parents listening out there, you know, when your child is demanding attention, do you give it to him? Do you give in to that? Or you know, try to stay above the fray. We ended up not covering the morning one, but after it became an issue with the governor's statement, we decided to cover the afternoon one. You know, had a reporter up there for that.
Yeah.
I think the state's COVID response has been hampered not just by these people on the extreme right, these, you know, people who feel like this is an infringement on their liberty, but also some of the state legislators who listen to them and push back against them, you know, themselves against when the governor tries to put into effect these, you know, safeguards that you know. So, in some ways, they've hampered the response too. I would hope that, you know, we've seen 20 deaths in the last 2 days, 10 deaths each day, tying our record high, and it's time that I would hope that people realize that it's time that we stop quibbling about you know, these issues, these abstract issues of liberty and freedom, and start realizing that this is a real threat to our community, and start pulling together. You know, somebody mentioned to me, a friend of mine mentioned to me recently that during the Olympics, you know, you saw this great community spirit. You saw all these people pulling together for a common cause, and we are so far from that now. We can't even, you know, see it in the rearview mirror. You know, it's selfish. We're seeing a lot of selfishness and a lot of disregard for human life.
All right. Robert Gerke is a news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. I'll just mention that you are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW, and we are going to take a quick break. And when we return, we will turn to more reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. Again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune interim editor David Noyce, reporter Taylor Stevens, and news columnist Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you can call us to join this conversation. The number is 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. All right, well, from the story of COVID, we will turn now to some big business stories to cover. The business of sports and the business of news. Let's save the journalistic self-reflection for just a second, and Tribune interim editor David Noyce. Let's talk about the Utah Jazz. The Miller family is selling a majority interest in the franchise and the Vivint Arena, and various other things. Who are they selling to?
They're selling to Ryan Smith, and I guess his wife, and he is a co-founder of Qualtrics. The sale was for reportedly about $1.6 billion, and frankly, it was surprising. I didn't see this coming.
The Miller family has been doing this since the mid 1980s. Was there? I don't know if this is in the reporting, but was there a central motivator for selling now? Did Gail Miller say that?
Well, it was interesting because the family had just several years ago set this up as a legacy trust, which envisioned the Jazz, of course, staying here and staying within the family, in the Miller family, in some form for as long as time could be shown, you know, for in perpetuity. But it wasn't really articulated why it was the Miller family didn't articulate why they were choosing to do this now. However, COVID, I think, may have had a role in it. The Larry Miller group of companies has taken a real hit, of course. Auto sales, we know, have been spotty and rocky. The entertainment venues, of course, aren't bringing in any of the money that they used to bring in under COVID. And so they've had to have a string of layoffs and furloughs. Sure, it's being very hard on the companies, and perhaps it was really just a combination of that and an interested party in buying that led to this decision that's happening now.
Well, just on that part of it, is it kind of a weird time to buy a team? I'm thinking about ticket sales and you know, arenas and our pandemic reality. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about also who. You know, you said it's Ryan Smith, and he's the one of the founders or co-founders of Qualtrics. Who is Ryan Smith, and what is Qualtrics, David Noyce?
Qualtrics is a software company that they do kind of employee surveys for companies. It's sort of the gold standard right now in helping companies get feedback from customers and the public, and it was a very successful operation. Almost from the get-go, it was founded by Ryan and his brother, I think Jared, and their father, who was a professor, also was involved, at least in helping formulate the ideas. And it took off. They sold the company for, I think, $8 billion to a German software company a couple years ago. That really spun heads on Wall Street, but Ryan Smith retains majority, you know, an interest in the company and running the company. He's like in his 40s. was born in Oregon, went to school at BYU, is a huge basketball fan, currently has a basketball court at his home. If you go into Qualtrics' office, there's a basketball court there. So is a huge basketball and a huge Jazz fan. So apparently seems very committed to helping the Jazz grow and be successful here in Utah.
Okay. In the press conference, I noticed that he said that he had a long, you know, affiliation and affinity for the team and even played junior Jazz basketball, like a lot of kids growing up here. I'm the same age as him and played. I wonder if we played against each other. did he, I mean, so that's probably the motivation for him. He just wanted to own the Jazz. This was something that he had as a goal.
Well, I think he indicated that he was interested in a sports franchise, and the Jazz is close to his heart, so I think it's the one he always wanted, and wanted to own. And I don't know, apparently there were overtures made, and at some point the Miller family decided to bite, and it was a good time to sell. The Miller family, And you, like I say, Ryan has already been involved with the Jazz. He was helping fund the Five for the Fight cancer things that you've been seeing on Jazz jerseys. So he had close associations there. It sounds like he wants to build a winner here. So that's what a lot of sports fans would want to know, is the investment going to lead to a title the Jazz have been pursuing since they came. And
yeah,
I guess that's just lost my train of thought.
No, sure, you're fine. Since they came from New Orleans, I was just thinking about that. That was earlier, and that was we can get into the history of the organization, or maybe not. But we should say that it's not just the Jazz organization. As I said, there's some other assets as well. Vivint Arena, the Salt Lake Bees.
Mm-hmm. The Salt Lake Bees, which I think the Miller family, I'm not sure, is still going to be involved with Larry Miller, you know, the patriarch of the Millers, the late Larry Miller is in the Softball Hall of Fame. So hardball is really close to his heart. Was close to his heart. So, and obviously the G League team also will also now be run by the Smiths.
Right.
So the Jazz front office seems to be in good shape. I wouldn't expect huge changes there. Dennis Lindsay and his quadra is compatriots that work in the office there seem to be well positioned and seem to have a lot of support for the direction they've been taking the team. It perhaps because the NBA and because of COVID, maybe it was an opportune time to buy the team. Maybe the price was a little bit cheaper. I don't know. But although it didn't seem like it went for the cheap, that's for sure. So that might have also been a factor as to why the sell went down now.
Robert Gerke, news columnist, I know that you are a Utah Jazz fan. Any thoughts on all this?
I think obviously the Miller family has done a tremendous service to the state, I think, by through their ownership of the Jazz, Gail Miller in particular, for these last years. I think one of the striking things about this is they bought, when Larry bought half of the franchise 35 years ago, he bought it for $8 million, bought the other half for another $14 million, so paid about $22 million, ended up selling it for $1.6 billion. It's remarkable how the sport has grown and how the value of these franchises has grown. But I think one of the things you can also take away from that is that this franchise would probably be worth a lot more in another state. And they've been committed to Utah and keeping the franchise here. And, you know, for a number of years, there were obviously some ups and downs, but putting a good product and a competitive product on the floor. And so, I'm hopeful, and I think from what I've heard from Ryan Smith, what he said publicly, he remains committed to that and keeping the Jazz an integral part of the fabric of our state and our community.
Okay. I'm going to remind listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Now we are going to turn to another story of business here in Utah, a news story about the news, something that we have periodically talked about on this show through the years. David Noyce, interim editor of the Tribune News, broke this week that both your paper and the Deseret News are making a rather significant transition with the turn of the new year. The print edition is, for the most part, going away. What's happening, David, with both papers, and why? It's a giant question, but yeah, what's the basics?
Well, on Monday, the two newspapers announced that they would be ending their joint operating agreement at year's end. Now, what we call the JOA was an agreement that allows the two newspapers to combine on printing, delivery, and ad sales for their print edition. So, strictly on those business side, the two papers were allowed essentially to collude, to legally collude and combine their operations to cover those expenses. That has been in place since 1952, so it's 68 years that joint operating agreement was working. It was renewed several times. But at the end of the year, that will be no more. The editorial and news sides of both operations have always been distinct and separate completely, but now every tie will be separate. And then each newspaper announced separately what they plan to do. The Tribune has chosen to continue to do a print publication. It would be a weekly that would be delivered through the mail to people's homes, businesses, and also some single copy sales at retail outlets on Saturday, mailed out on Friday and on Saturday. So it'll be like it obviously won't have a breaking news element. We'll have a lot of our best enterprise work and kind of looking at the week ahead, the week back. It will have all the furniture that readers love to have on Sunday, full color comics and puzzles and obituaries, things that people want to have that can still work in a weekly edition. And the Deseret News is going to do the same. They're going to go to a weekly. Also, they will also continue to print their LDS Church News, and they're also putting out a national weekly edition that they've had a national edition for several years now. They're going to continue that on a weekly, and they'll also have a monthly magazine. So they're doing a little bit more, but we're doing a weekly is what we're going to. The reason for this, of course, is because printing a paper every day is costing us money. The print edition has been losing money, has been losing readers for a long time, for years now. It's been a steady decline. At one point, we had a Sunday circulation approaching 200,000, 190,000. We're down to between 25,000 and 35,000 in print. So producing the paper every day in a print product was actually costing us money, forcing us to make cutbacks in the journalism we do. We've had significant layoffs in the last 4 or 5 years, losing reporting staff. So it was affecting the journalism we're doing. We feel like going to a weekly edition, we can actually turn print into a money maker and help us to sustain our journalism. More than 80% of our readers are online. They're getting their news from our website, and that continues to grow. So this will allow us to bolster our journalism, our daily journalism on our website, still having all that premium content and enterprise work on the website as well, yet still satisfy those readers who love the feel of the paper on their hands, have that ritual. We're very sad about the fact that ritual is going to be disrupted.
You know, well, okay, so you said that most people read online now. I've had years of conversations with multiple editors at the Tribune about this. Terry Orme talked about the economics of print and how they just weren't there. Jennifer Napier-Pierce did as well. And for years, I mean, this is about advertising dollars just not being there in print. Is that the long and the short of it, Dave?
Yes, it is. Advertisers have dropped off. It used to be most of our revenue for print came from advertising. And that was a model that worked for newspapers for a long time. They used to be big money makers, as a matter of fact. We've all seen Citizen Kane, so we know how newspapers could bring in big dollars. But that's completely changed now. Advertisers, there's other places they can go to target their audiences more effectively on the internet and more cheaply. So most of our money was coming, frankly, from circulation, those dedicated readers who continue to want to get it. And that's why you've seen as those have dropped, of course, then the bankroll behind print continue to drop too.
You may not be able to answer this question, Dave, but did subscriptions, you know, themselves not cover the costs of the print operations and you know, the delivery and all the rest of it?
No, they don't. We'd need much heavier print circulation to be able to make that pencil out into the black.
You mentioned the JOA going away, the joint operating agreement between the two papers that governed that printing and delivering of both of them. As a result of that going away, the presses are shuttering. The Newspaper Agency Corporation is 161 people at NAC are losing their jobs. Can I ask, is Newspaper Agency Corporation jointly owned by the two papers, or you know, how did that operate?
Yes, the NAC, which is Utah Media Group too, was set up through the joint operating agreement to take care of the business side of the paper, and that's a really sad part. Of course, is 161 people, you know, will be losing their jobs. I don't know if some of them may be retained. Both papers will still need to have people involved in sales and things like that. So, and distribution, although be a different way. So yeah. maybe they'll come on to some of those operations. The Deseret News is also trimming its staff somewhat. We're hopeful and plan to retain our staff that we have of about 65 in our newsroom. Our production side of our has already been scaled way back anyway. We don't have as many staffers as we used to have involved in production. People have noticed that our papers have been getting thinner through the years, our daily papers. So we still need to have some production staff to put out our Sunday product, which will be a bulked up product. It won't be just your Sunday paper you've been getting now. It will have we're still working on and planning on exactly what this will all contain and how we're going to pull it off. So we'll still need a production staff, but we'll also need to redeploy some of those to our web operations, which we want to bolster.
Can I ask just a quick question about NAC, which is, I know that they also print you may not be able to answer this question, but they also print, for example, the New York Times here in northern Utah. Do you know what's happening with that? No more physical New York Times because of this as well?
I don't know, but they're going to have to find another printer, it sounds like.
Okay.
The New York Times, USA Today, I can't remember if the Wall Street Journal also. They print a couple, another number of other publications. So they'll be like what we're doing, which is in negotiations with a printing outlet here in Utah.
Okay. Boy, you know, we're running low on time, but I want to just ask a couple of questions. I was an intern at a paper, kind of a weird paper, the Buenos Aires Herald, an English language newspaper in Argentina. That paper had a bunch of ownership changes. Then they went from a daily print edition to a weekly. And then not long after that, you know, after 140 years of printing, they closed up shop. Is this a scary sign to you or a hopeful sign to you? Obviously, it's not the same situation, but I do worry about the future.
Well, frankly, for me, it's somewhat of a sad time. You know, I don't relish the fact that we're not going to be delivering a print product every single day. That's sad. That's lamentable. It's something I grew up with. You know, I had family members who worked at newspapers. It's kind of how it got in my blood. So it's a sad time that way. It's a hopeful time in that I think We think we can actually make a weekly product as a print product work. We're certainly aiming on it being successful, and maybe it's a path for print to continue to exist through the future. But either way, what we really are interested in is the journalism that we do, and bolstering our website where most of our readers are, and getting the news out to people, the enterprise work out to our readers as effectively and efficiently as we can. I think it's important to remember in newspaper, you know, the news part is the most important part of it, more important than the paper part. We made this move in the interest of journalism and serving readers at the end of the day, because it just wasn't going to work the other way. We're a nonprofit also. So we're sort of a big experimental lab anyway. We're a community asset now. And so we want to serve the community. Anything we make goes back into the operation. So that's I think, is another thing that gives me some hope. But I'm still sad about this day coming.
There's so many questions that I have, and I've got Taylor Stevens, who's been waiting on the phone the whole time for this, for us to cover the stories that she did as a journalist at the Salt Lake Tribune, and I want to get to them. And so I just want to mention that on another program this week on KCPW's In the Hive, I spoke with a media business analyst for the journalism think tank and school. Pointer, and he kind of reiterated some of what you're saying, Dave, that it's not helpful to necessarily wallow in the nostalgia of the print paper. He did talk about some papers out there who have made the same move, adopting a kind of digital replica of the physical paper, because sometimes you get the feeling that you missed a story, something vanishes in the jumble of pages on the internet, or you see something on the homepage and then you can't find it again. Mm-hmm. Any plans for a kind of, daily definitive edition, PDF or whatever, of what the Tribune has decided are the most important stories for people to follow?
Yeah. Yeah, Roger, I love that e-edition, as a matter of fact. That's how I have a great delivery person of my print product, and sometimes it's on my doorstep at 2 or 3 in the morning, because our press run is so short now, it doesn't take very long to print them. I get it really early, but I don't even go get that. I look at our e-edition, which is emailed to me, and I see a digital replica of the paper, and I read the paper there, and my hands stay clean. So I love that, and we are definitely trying to explore it would probably be scaled back, but some kind of scaled back e-edition that would still give the benefit of reading the paper, of taking one of the great benefits of that is you have professional journalists then sort of ordering the news for you. Here's what's most important, and that's an invaluable tool. Sometimes it's hard to tell on the web because the web has everything there. You may miss a story that you really want or should know about. That has been ordered by a professional journalist, kind of, stacking them for you. So you can say, here's the lead story, here's something else you should know. And also have some of the other fixtures that people love to have start their morning with, their daily crosswords. We have those online now, but they'd have their daily crosswords, or maybe some comics, maybe some puzzles and things like that.
Sure.
But have that e-edition. We really are looking at ways of doing that. Nothing else, we are definitely going to be bolstering our daily newsletter, which will help people also stay up to speed. But we are very interested in continuing some kind of e-edition.
All right, Robert Grigg, I'm going to give you a last word on this. I mean, one of the things that strikes me about the move to digital is that people on the internet seek out the information they want. And, for those people who were still reading the newspaper, the actual physical newspaper, they would come across news that they might not necessarily have, gone and sought out in their own little silo. But that's still kind of not the majority of people who are reading the news at the Tribune, apparently. I guess, your thoughts on the move away from print after 149 years.
I mean, I think that is a really interesting point you made. That I and people I've talked to over the last week or so since this announcement was made, or the last several days at least, have all kind of referenced that. You see things when you're reading through the newspaper that you don't see on the website, and you get viewpoints that you don't necessarily get when you're relying on your Facebook feed, for example, or things that people are sharing. I think it's a really sad thing. I grew up on newspapers. I loved reading the newspaper. But I've got kids, and they are not going to read the newspaper. They've proven that. I think I feel bad for some of the older subscribers who are now being asked to make a difficult transition to a digital format that they might not be comfortable with. And they've been reading the Tribune a lot longer than Dave or I have, and now are being put in this, this almost untenable situation. I think it is sad, but it also is inevitable, as Dave mentioned. I think there's, the whole notion of having a printed product thrown on your doorstep by a paper boy a carrier in the 21st century is a little arcane. And it wasn't, economically feasible. So we're going to, as Dave mentioned, we're going to keep doing the best journalism we can. Hopefully this bolsters our newsroom and makes it more financially viable going forward, because the path we were on just wasn't.
I'm going to cut you off there, Robert, and I want to, because for the past hour I've had Taylor Stevens waiting on the line. Listeners, I'll make the pitch too that it seems like subscribing is the best way that you can support the journalists who are doing the work they're doing. And Taylor Stevens, you are one of those journalists. We've kept you waiting in the wings the entire show, and I'm very sorry about that, but thanks for your patience. I want to turn now to some reporting that you did. You teamed up with a group called the Center for Responsive Politics to do some analysis of campaign donations during this presidential election cycle by women in Utah. And I think I'll let you just take it from there. Utah is a very red state, but donations from Utah women don't exactly reflect that.
Yeah, very interesting look at where women are putting their dollars in this election cycle. So Joe Biden, the Democratic nominee for president, has raised $708,000 from Utah women, while Trump has brought in just $429,000 from Utah women. Men have kind of given about equal measure to each of the candidates, to Joe Biden, as well as to Republican nominee President Donald Trump. But we are seeing a pretty big gap when it comes to female voters in this election cycle.
Where does this financial data come from? You know, this campaign fundraising information, Taylor?
Yeah, this comes from the Federal Election Commission. They disclose or itemize contributions along with identifying information anytime someone contributes more than $200 to a candidate. So with that caveat, we're able to kind of look and see where Utah women specifically are putting their money. And one thing that's interesting to note is this divide in campaign contributions. Obviously, it doesn't always mean that because a candidate has more money, they're going to get more votes. But it does appear to align with some polling that has been done in Utah that shows that men are more likely to support the president and women are more evenly split between the two candidates. And this is something we're seeing nationally as well. Surveys show Biden is polling around 25 points better than Trump among women.
This is a bit of a tangled question, but it's simply why. Why are more women and Utah women, you know, a majority of donors who are women in a very red state in support of and giving to the Democratic candidate?
Yeah, there's a couple of answers to that, and one that I thought was really interesting. A researcher at the University of Utah, Hinckley Institute of Politics, said that there's a shift in recent years where in the past, women in a marriage or a partnership, they might be more likely to align politically with their husband and their donations would follow the man in their life. And now we're starting to see, you know, women who have kind of gained a new consciousness, so to speak, with the Me Too movement and the women's marches that we've seen. And some of that also has to do, political scientists say, with some of the misogyny that they have seen on the part of the president. He has been accused of sexual assault or non-consensual physical contact by at least 25 women. He has a long history of attacking women based on their appearance or their weight, of comparing women to animals. And so the political scientists I've spoken to all think that that kind of plays in those different circumstances to encouraging women to become more politically involved, not only with their votes, but also becoming more involved with campaigns, becoming more involved in, you know, actually putting their dollars where their vote is.
You highlight in this article the contributions, financial contributions of a couple of women from different parts of the state who happen to be members of the predominant faith here, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, donations to Joe Biden. And then you also talk about how some of the campaign fundraising is spilling over into the 4th district race. Can you explain that, Taylor?
Yes, we're seeing a similar divide in the 4th district race between Republican candidate Burgess Owens and the incumbent Representative Ben McAdams. And that is a really close race, closely watched, one of the tightest in the country. And we'll see how that plays out on Tuesday. But we see that among women, McAdams has received 35% of his donations from that group, and Owens has brought in about 24% from women. So there's also a gender divide, you know, not only on the national level, but also spilling into some of our local politics as well.
Just before we wrap up and turn to our underplayed stories of the week, you shared a byline on this story with Grace Haley from the Center for Responsive Politics. Grace, I know, is a native Utahn, but who is the Center for Responsive Politics that she works for and who you collaborated with on this?
Yeah, they do a lot of analysis around campaign finance and with a lot of focus on D.C., but they just kind of, their aim is to look and see how these political donations are playing out, I guess, and they do a lot of analysis for that. So they did the data analysis that is really the backbone of the story.
I had meant to, there's some really interesting data and reporting in your article, and thank you very much. I'd meant to save time for another story you reported about the fact that 7 Utah cities have now bailed out of an Idaho nuclear power project. However, we are out of time, and Taylor, maybe I'll just let you start with a very quick underplayed story of the week, and I'll ask for a quick one from each of you.
Yeah, I'm going to highlight Bethany Rogers' reporting on one of the constitutional amendments on the ballot. This is the one for a Utah constitutional protection for hunting and fishing. If you're still holding on to your ballot, it's worth reading that story for a little bit more analysis on that particular constitutional amendment.
Great. Thank you, Taylor, for that. Gerke, your pick for underplayed story of the week, and quickly.
I thought it was really interesting this week that Dallin Oaks, the number 2 guy in the LDS church at a devotional at BYU, said that Black Lives Matter. It's an eternal truth. I think the timing of this is really interesting. Obviously, the phrase Black Lives Matter is politically charged.
Yeah.
And I think it was a strong statement. You can read about it at sltrip.com.
All right. And David Noyce, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Juliet Tennert is poised to become the newest member of the Liquor Commission. She's the chief economist at the Kempsey Gardner Policy Institute, and she is a drinker. So the drinkers still remain a majority on the Utah Liquor Commission.
All right, check that out at sltrip.com. I'll go with 2 Brian Maffley stories. One is that the EPA, or that the Trump administration is delisting wolves, taking them off the Endangered Species Act or list, and then also that the EPA, the headline is the EPA guts a plan that would have slashed pollution from Utah coal plants. Check both of those out as well at sltrip.com. Some interesting environment reporting from Brian Maffley. David Noyce, sorry, Robert Gerke and Taylor Stevens, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That does it for Behind the Headlines. Thanks for listening, and join us again next week.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.